and welcome to Your Homegrown Food. I'm your host, Jonna, and you are tuned into Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM and freakradio.org on the internet. And on today's show, I will be playing a talk by Eric Holt Jimenez on global food sovereignty. And Eric Holt Jimenez is an agroecologist and political economist. He is the executive director of Food First Institute for Food and Development Policy and the author of the 2009 Food First book, Food Rebellions, Crisis and the Hunger for Justice. Eric Holt Jimenez presentation given at the 2009 Econvergence Conference in Portland, Oregon, entitled The Fourfold Crisis, Food Movements, and Regime Change. Food sovereignty is the political concept that the platform advanced by Via Campesina some 13 years ago. Basically, food sovereignty is people's right to healthy and culturally appropriate food produced through ecological sound and sustainable methods, and the right to define their own food and agricultural systems. So, oh boy, that's a lot of staticky noise there. Hopefully the sound will be okay on this talk I'm going to play for you now. So, here we go, Eric Holt Jimenez. Oh boy, sorry about that.
Aside from record harvests and record hunger, we also had record profits last year. Talking about the bumper profits from the last quarter of last year of ADN, our 20% increases in profits. Monsanto, 45% increase in profits. Cargill, 86% increase in their profits. General Foods, 61% increase in their profits. Mosaic Fertilizer, subsidiary of Cargill, 1,700% increase in profits in the last quarter of 2008. Well, we see a dichotomy here, don't we? So some people are suffering, and others are making money off of that suffering. Now, there was a lot of talk in the media when the food crisis hit. Suddenly, meet that price inflation here. Prices. And certainly around the world, developing countries which have become dependent on the global market for their grains were having a very hard time. We're having a very hard time accessing those grains and feeding their people. And so the mainstream media basically attributed the food crisis to what I call the proximate causes. And that's what we heard about, just the proximate causes. The first one was climate. Oh dear, climate change is upon us, and look what happens. We get these big droughts in Australia. The wheat harvest fails, and now we have we don't have enough food to go around. There's some truth to that. There's a terrible drought in Australia. We do have climate change affecting our weather systems and our food systems, but still, we had more than enough food. A lot of talk was about the rising meat consumption in the newly emerging economies of India, China, and Brazil. How dare those middle classes attempt to consume as much beef, grain-fed beef, as people in the United States? Supposedly, they were the ones causing the problem, sending the prices of grain going up because they wanted to eat too much grain-fed beef. I'll address that in a minute because it happened to be false. There was a 5% fall in cereal production in 2005-2006, but we still had more than enough food to go around. And like I'm saying, 2007 and into 2008, we had bumper harvests. The other proximate cause, if there's some truth to, was we had very low grain reserves. Our grain reserves were down to about 54 days worldwide. Yeah, I know. They're working on it. The other, of course, and we're going to have to ask, and then we'll answer in a minute, what happened to our grain reserves. They didn't just disappear accidentally. They were legislated out of existence. The other, of course, which everybody knew about, was the rise in oil prices. When it went up over $100 a barrel, and of course that doubles transport costs. And since so much of the food which we eat travels at least 2,000 kilometers, 1,600 miles or so, it affected the price of food. Fertilizer costs went up three times, which is why Mosaic Fertilizer was able to make a profit of 1,700% in the last quarter of 2008. The other proximate cause, very much linked to more structural causes, was the spread of biofuels, which I call agrofuels, because these are industrial biofuels. I'm not talking about, you know, kitchen grease and whatnot. I'm talking about plowing under large parts of the rainforest and growing sugarcane for agrofuels, for ethanol, for export. I'm talking about the Midwest moving from a food to a fuel economy and shunting all of our corn into ethanol production, which of course sent up the price of corn. And finally, especially after the ethanol boom began to nudge corn prices up, and investors began to pile into the ethanol market, then we get financial speculation. Then we get Wall Street and Chicago coming in full force and pumping up the price of food with speculation, with buying through futures, in order to make profits. I mean, this is the same financial money which developed the housing bubble and was looking around for something to invest in after the bubble burst. It's the same money which, prior to that, invested in the dot-com boom, and when that burst, had to invest in housing. So what we see is a series of bubbles, and in 2008, food became one of those bubbles for the financial sector. But these are still all the proximate causes. These are all the causes that we talk about if we don't know our history. And what we're not talking about are the root causes. And the root cause, the one single root cause, is that we have a vulnerable global food system in which over 90% of the cropland is devoted to five crops: cotton, maize, wheat, rice, and soy. And most of these crops are grown in the global north and exported around the world. We overproduce in this country, pumping our cropland full of water, full of fertilizer, full of pesticides, so that it produces more than the land actually has to give. And then the surplus of that overproduction, which we can't possibly consume here, we ship out around the world. But since there are farmers all over the world, the first thing we have to do is destroy their markets so that we can sell our grain to those companies, to those countries. And I'll explain how that happened in just a minute. But what that means is that we have a food system which is highly vulnerable to both environmental shock and economic shock. It is dependent on such a small range of crops and controlled by a handful of monopolies, that there's no way that the food system can possibly attain any level of stability. So it's highly vulnerable to shock. And the other root cause is what I call the industrial agri-foods complex. These are the giant oligopolies, the grain traders and the processors, the seed and genetic engineering companies, and the giant retail distributing companies that control the food system. These are the ones who profit. These are the ones who hold back the grain as Archer Daniels Midland did in Mexico, causing the tortilla crisis. And then when the price of grain goes up, then they begin to sell. These are the hoarders. These are the ones who diversify their assets and pump the price of grain up through the financial markets. These are the ones who take most of the food dollar. You know, 50, 60 years ago, farmers used to get about 60% of the food dollar, up to 70% of the food dollar. Now they get 15, if they're lucky, 18% of the food dollar. And with that, they have to pay for the production costs. You know, where does it go? Farmers produce, and they don't know who eats their food. Consumers eat the food, and they don't know where it came from. Why? Because it's obscured by the agri-foods industrial complex, which takes the largest share of the food dollar. And it's a big dollar. $6 trillion a year. Food is a big business. So how did we get this industrial agri-food complex? Where did it come from? I mean, one can go historically back into the roots of colonialism and from Jefferson on, etc. But let's, and based on slavery and the piracy of the early pirates, as Buckminster Fuller used to call them, went around the world stealing the seeds on the U.S. cavalry, which cleaned the American West of its indigenous people so the United States could expand. But let's start with the Green Revolution. Let's not go that far back. Let's start with the Green Revolution. The Green Revolution started in the 1960s and 70s. If you're not familiar with it, it was basically a campaign to export industrial agriculture from the industrial north, from the United States, into the global south, into what we then called the third world, and then later we called them the developing countries. And this was initially financed by the Ford and Rockefeller foundations. And one of the men that they hired, one of the researchers they hired, was Norman Borlaug. And Norman Borlaug found that he went around the world and stole seeds from farmers and then made crosses, hybrids, of the best seeds, searching for the particular characteristics that you were looking for, that you could produce what we then were then called high-yielding varieties, HYVs. And they did yield a lot more, 20, 30, 40% more than the traditional seeds that they had been drawn from. But they only yield higher if you put on all of the fertilizer, all of the water, all of the pesticides, and use the machinery in order to make them yield more. If you don't do those things, they don't yield more. So what did this do? We set up 13 international agricultural research stations funded by countries of the global north through quotas in order to develop these seeds all around the world in what's called the Centers of Genetic Diversity, the Vavilov Centers of Genetic Diversity. So obviously they went to Mesoamerica, which is the home of corn. And they went to the Philippines, which is the home of rice. And when they first arrived in the Philippines in the 1960s, the Philippines farmers were planting nearly 2,000 varieties of rice. It's not unusual for one single small farmer to have 20 or 30 varieties growing on a small plot of land at the same time. I'll fast forward very quickly for you. If you can find 3 varieties of rice in the Philippines today, you'd be lucky. They're gone. They've been stolen. They sit in a huge seed bank in the Philippines, controlled by the Institute for Rice Research, International Institute for Rice Research. But the farmers don't have those seeds anymore. This happened all around the world. And the other thing that happened was, as these seeds were given out, first of all, to buy the seeds, you needed money. So you got to get credit. You could only get the credit if you had something for collateral, like land. So the Green Revolution immediately favored landed farmers. Those small farmers, the billion farmers of the world who didn't have land rights, didn't have immediate access to these seeds. Then you had to buy the fertilizers, the pesticides, and use the machinery. And then you got a big crop. So what happened in the first instance of the Green Revolution was that the smallholders around the world, who really fed the world up until that point, were pushed off their land by the larger farmers, who had financing, who had seeds, who had the backing of the governments, and who had all of the encouragement from the United States, of course. These farmers then migrated, on one hand, to the hillsides, the fragile hillsides of the tropics, to the forested frontiers of the rainforests. They chopped down trees looking for nutrients so they could grow their basic grains. And they migrated to the cities, where they formed a huge reserve army of labor for the factories, for manufacturing, for industry. But that's also where we got the city's slums. If you read a very interesting book by Mike Davis called Planet of Slums, he tracks this. Basically, we are now a planet of slums. Most of the world's urban population lives in slums. And this is when it first began to happen, with the Green Revolution. But as a result, there's a tremendous amount of production of food. Because on one hand, you have the farmers on the hillsides, and farmers accessing the nutrients from the rainforest. So you have extra production there because you've increased the land base. And on the other hand, you have this intensified production in the lowland, in the bottomlands, where larger farmers are using these high-yielding varieties with all of the benefits of the inputs and the investment and the credit. The second, and during that period, what happened was that farmers around the world became dependent on the inputs coming out of the global north, the fertilizers, the seeds, pesticides, machinery. So it really was colonization of the global south by agro-industry from the global north. Tremendously successful in that regard, and also we got a flush of production, which then brought the price of food down. And there was a trend in these low food prices for 30 years. The next step in the rise of the industrial agri-foods complex were these structural adjustment policies of the 1980s and the 1990s. Now, these are the policies imposed by the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund on countries in the global south who are defaulting on their debts. Now, I'm not going to get into the causes of the debt crisis, but it's safe to say that we had a debt crisis in this country as well, just like the one in the global south. And that debt crisis in the 70s was with our farm sector. And we lost half of our farmers in this country during the debt crisis. And that's when we had Earl Butts, Secretary of Agriculture, say, get big or get out. So everybody tried to get big, and they pushed off half of the farmers out. And they all defaulted on their debts, and they were all given, the larger farmers, and they were all given extensions. They were all bailed out. Some of us here helped to bail them out, those who were paying taxes at the time. In the global south, they weren't so lucky. Because if the prices for their products, which they had been overproducing, sank, the banks in the north decided to call back their loans. And the global south couldn't pay. And that's when you get the third world debt crisis. So the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank step in to save the day. And they extend loans to the governments of the global south on some very interesting conditions. First condition, these countries had to remove all of their tariff barriers. Second condition, they had to sell off all of their state-owned enterprises. Third condition, they had to dismantle their marketing boards. Fourth condition, they had to dismantle their grain reserves. Fifth condition, they had to move into export crops, luxury export crops. So in other words, they had to dismantle their food system in order to allow for the colonization of that food system by the companies of the global north. Those were the conditions if they wanted money in order to pay off the debts which they had incurred during what were called the development decades of the 60s and 70s. And the third step in establishing the dominance of the industrial agri-food complex over our food systems in the world is the free trade mania, which took hold from the 1980s right on into the present. We're still in this, in which the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the GATT, is turned into the WTO, the World Trade Organization. And we get the free trade agreements like NAFTA and CAFTA. And what these agreements do, essentially, is to cement into law, by cementing into international treaty, the structural adjustment programs applied by the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. Now, this shouldn't be a surprise. The G8 countries run the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. The G8 countries run the WTO. The United States runs NAFTA. It's important to realize that these institutions, particularly let's take the World Bank, their mission is to end poverty worldwide. That's a great mission, right? On board with that mission. But what they don't talk about is their job. Their job is to resolve the crises of capital in favor of the G8. The directors of the World Bank sit around twice a week and play poker. You take this project, you give me that project, you can have that market, but I'll take this market. No, I'll up you that market over there. They're using the economies of the third world, and they're using development, they're using tax dollars. By the way, the 10,000 people who work for the World Bank don't pay any taxes. They're using that to advance the interests of the G8. And what are the interests of the G8? Well, I think it's pretty clear. In the case of food, the interests of the G8 are the interests of the industrial agri-foods complex. And so now we have treaties, international treaties, that oblige states in the global south to permit the dumping of subsidized products from the global north into their local markets. So farmers, let me take that back, not farmers, because farmers don't export grain. Archer Daniel Midland, Cargill, Dreyfus, Bungie, these giant companies, they export grain. So these companies are able to dump grain into the global south and sell it at under the cost of production. And that puts all the farmers in the global south out of business and makes them dependent on the grain produced in the United States. Now, it's not like farmers here get a good deal out of it. Most farmers one talks to don't really want these subsidies at all. They'd rather just get a fair price. For their grain, just pay me a fair price. They don't get a fair price. Why don't they get a fair price? Because if they were to get a fair price, if the government, for example, was to go back to the policies of the 1930s and 40s and say, no, this is the price for grain. This is what's going to cover the cost of production and cover the environmental and social externalities, then ADM, Cargill, Bungie, Dreyfus would have to pay 3 or 4 or 5 times more for their grain. So they don't want that. So we have to make it up by paying for the subsidies. And they get the grain on the cheap, and they go down and destroy the markets in the global south and create dependency on the global market for these countries' food security. So what are the results? Building up 50 years of building this industrial agri-foods complex. Maybe you don't know that in the 1970s, the global south was not only self-sufficient in food, because we're taught that they're always hungry and they need us. In fact, they were self-sufficient in food in the 1970s before all this happened. In fact, they even used to export a surplus of $1 billion a year. Not a tremendous amount by global standards, but nothing to be ashamed of. Now they import $11 billion a year in food. industrial agriculture, which was really a rather small sector of agriculture 50 years ago, which had its niche here in the United States and in parts of Europe, now is dominant and produces 20% of the world's greenhouse gases because it's so inefficient and so dirty. It also uses up 80% of the world's available water. And it's contributed to the loss of 75% of the crop diversity in the world. In other words, we've lost 75% of our crop diversity thanks to the monopolization of these seeds, thanks to the concentration of the control of seeds in a few companies. This is extremely dangerous. This is the type of loss of diversity which created things like the potato famine in Ireland. We need diversity in order to deal with all of the unpredictability that nature throws at us. And now, with climate change, it's going to be that much worse. After 20 years of trade liberalization, sub-Saharan Africa has probably lost about $300 billion, something close to $300 billion, because they're on the wrong end of the global trading stick. They lost that much revenue as a result of global trading. It's been calculated by Oxfam. That's about what we pay to go to sub-Saharan Africa in foreign aid. So, wouldn't it have been better just to let them produce their own food? Here in the United States, something like 1.3 million Mexican campesinos and campesinas, smallholders, farmers, went bankrupt as a result of NAFTA. And we got millions of immigrants coming into the United States. The other day I was talking to a farmer in California, and he was lamenting the fact that he was getting old. And he said, there's no farmers to take over the land anymore. My kids don't want to work anymore. What are we going to do? There's no more farmers. And I felt sorry for him. I felt sorry that the kids didn't want to take over the land. I knew why. They couldn't make a good living at it. But he didn't look around him. If he'd looked at his workers, they were Mexican farmers before they came to be his workers. If he looked at the restaurant chefs, they were all Mexican farmers before they came up here to work for a lousy wage. There are farmers all over this country. You just got to open your eyes and find them. They're there. And there are millions of young people who would love to get into farming. They're all there. I should say that the Green Revolution, aside from allowing the...
All right, you've been listening to Global Food Sovereignty by Eric Holt Jimenez here on Your Homegrown Food, the radio show about food, on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM and freakradio.org on the internet. And if you would like to hear the whole talk, well, I'll play the second half next week at 11:30 on Wednesday. And if you would like to find the whole talk and listen to it on your own, it's on YouTube. Just look for Eric Holt Jimenez, or you can find a link to it on my Facebook page, Your Homegrown Food Show on Facebook. So thank you, everyone, for tuning in. And you can tune in Your Homegrown Food every Wednesday at 11:30, from 11:30 to 12. And get more information about my show, Your Homegrown Food Show, on Facebook. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and I'll see you all next week.